This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lissina. Today, we talk to Adam Braun. 10 years ago, he founded Pencils of Promise, a nonprofit that built more than 400 schools across the globe and earned him a Jefferson Award for public service, an honor he shares with the likes of Bill Gates and Cesar Chavez. His latest initiative is Mission U, a college alternative where students study things like analytics and business intelligence, a curriculum designed to help them land in-demand jobs at companies like Lyft and Spotify. There's no upfront tuition, but once students get a job paying $50,000 a year, they pay a share of their earnings for 3 years. He'll talk about the hard work of making big change happen and what anyone can learn. Hi, Adam. How are you?
I'm doing great today.
Very good. Very good. Well, we're happy to have you. We're happy to have you. So, Adam, I'm very curious, and I'm sure our listeners are curious. Can you tell us a little bit more about Mission U, a little bit more details than what I gave people about sort of the partnerships and the job training that Mission U readies people for?
Sure. So Mission U is a one-year program, and it's really designed when taking into context what we believe higher education should look like if it was created for today, not for the world of, 100 or 400 or 50 or 30 years ago. And so what that means is, to begin with, it's shorter, it's accelerated and incredibly immersive. So it's this 12-month program, but at the same time, we charge absolutely no upfront tuition. A lot of the challenges around higher education today are that students are getting absolutely crushed with debt. And beyond having debt, they also don't have any of the relevant skills that are going to help position them for the lives and career that they aspire towards. And so you pay no upfront tuition at all when you get accepted into Mission U. We entirely invest into our students throughout their year-long program without them paying us anything whatsoever. And on the back end of that, we're only recipients of any type of tuition if and when they are successful. And the way that we deem that is when they've secured a job paying them $50,000 or more, at which point they contribute 15% of income for at most 36 months. So there's a cap on the top end. If they're making more than six figures or more, they wouldn't pay beyond 15%. And so, to begin with, there's a structure set up so that we as an institution can only be successful if our students are successful. So we completely align with them on day one in that regard. The second part is that we use blended learning, which means that our program is a combination of both online as well as in-person experiences. We just fundamentally believe that technology can enhance student learning, but it can't entirely replace what happens when you get in a room with like-minded or people who have divergent viewpoints from yourself. And that's really where soft skills are most heavily developed. And our curriculum is truly battle-tested. We partner with today's leading companies. That includes Spotify, Lyft, Uber, Warby Parker, Casper, Harry's, et cetera. And they really help us calibrate and design our curriculum. We have advisors and instructors from places like Harvard and Stanford and MIT. And it's truly a phenomenal experience that our students are just seeing tremendous growth through. And our employer partners, are really excited to gain access to tremendously diverse and very capable talent that already hit the ground running on day one to contribute to great companies.
Super, super. And this launched last March, so March of 2017. How many students have sort of gone through the program so far or are currently in the program?
Sure. So we target all cohorts around 25 students. That to us is the sweet spot. We opened up admissions last March, March 2017. And again, we were targeting 25 students and we had about 4,700 applicants for this program. We spent no paid marketing really of any kind, but there was this massive organic outreach. Fortunately, we had a lot of coverage about what this program looked like and essentially, how it was designed to either replace or augment a traditional college experience, in particular for those that were ambitious and really looking to level up their abilities in life and career. And so we ended up taking, obviously, a little bit more considering the demand. With you know a high 20s in a number of students in our first cohort, and these are folks that range in ages from 18 to 40. You know, it's not just students out of high school; those are kind of the outliers. Most of our students, I would say, are kind of early to mid 20s, some late 20s into their 30s, and you know, many of them have college experience previously. Some even have degrees, and you know, they come from really all over the country. With our second cohort that we opened up shortly thereafter. To start in January, we received about 5,500 applicants. And that cohort, we decided to try out actually the smaller approach. If the range is 20 to 30, we tried to go a little bit lower so that that's closer to 20 students. So we have almost 50 students in the program right now. It's high 40s. You know, our goal is not to turn people away. We want to let students in. We want to educate a lot of people and grow into serving thousands and tens of thousands and eventually hundreds of thousands of students. But we, you know, decided to stick with this cohort model. We think it's the most effective way to learn as well as to build relationships. And so at this point, we've decided to open up three times a year, rolling start dates, which are January, May, and September. So at any point in time, if an audience member is listening to this or thinks of somebody that they know that Mission U can be a fit for, they can just go to missionu.com, M-I-S-S-I-O-N-U.com, and slash apply, and they can start an application right there.
Sure, sure. And what are you looking for? The folks that have made it into these cohorts, what makes a Mission U student?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, one thing that's really important for me to call out is, you know, we don't prioritize or really, you know, for most students even look at SATs or GPA or any form of standardized testing. You know, they can be effective indicators. I would say GPA, not so much SAT or standardized tests of future aptitude, but ultimately we're not looking at your past test scores. We're looking for your future potential. Mm-hmm. And so what we in particular target and most heavily evaluate is the demonstration of soft skills and character traits. So we want to see resilience, we want to see grit, but we also want to see a real passion and conviction for your educational future. We also want to see that you're an effective team player. And so part of our application process includes a group challenge in which you are given a prompt, an ambiguous question without a defined solution. And we ask you and three other candidates who have just met for the first time online to essentially create a presentation together in the span of about 30 minutes and then deliver it together. And we want to see how you interact with others on real world problems and real world challenges that are indicative of what happens at a real world job. Yeah. So, you know, we look for effective communication. How are you, you know, as a communicator, both in written and verbal? So it's really that mix that we're looking for. And, you know, we have students that have come from top tier universities like University of Michigan and GW that have transferred directly into Mission U. But we also have students that, you know, are mid-career professionals, and we have others that, you know, went to local community college. So, you know, it's a really, really tremendously diverse group of students. And that's something that we hear across the board is that, you know, employers value folks who have not only diverse ethnic and gender backgrounds, especially in you know, technology fields, but, you know, taking a non-traditional route through your education also enables you to present a diverse perspective in, you know, the company context.
Sure, sure, sure. And what helped you land on that element, those sort of interactive group projects with other applicants? How did you land on that as an important part of this process?
Sure. So, you know, one of the individuals we spend a fair amount of time really working with and consulting with is a member of our advisory board, which is Dr. Tony Wagner from Harvard's Innovation Lab, one of the most famous Harvard professors who's been really involved with how we design the year, the experience, and, you know, even admissions. And, you know, it just continues to be highlighted to us by folks like Tony and you know, others that, you know, a lot of education is purely theoretical, mm-hmm. and it's designed for a world that we've moved past.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're now in a world where competency is what matters most. And there are, you know, job processes by which you can evaluate an individual's competency. You know, do they actually have the skills? And if they don't have the skills or experience, are you seeing what we have started to call internally a trajectory of excellence? Where, you know, you might have been a barista at Starbucks, but you demonstrated that you were promoted multiple times in a short period of time at Starbucks. You know, you may have been a ticket taker at a ball game, but you progressed from one job to another. And you demonstrated excellence across every opportunity that you were given. And those are the type of things that we really track for. And then we provide a really, I would say, incredible year. I mean, when we talk to our students about their experience at Mission U, I've heard, from students, they've told me and others outright, look, I have a bachelor's degree and I've learned more in my first 3 months at Mission U than I did in all 4 years of my undergraduate education combined. So we know the curriculum is working. We're hearing the feedback from the students as well as the employer market, and it's really exciting.
Sure, sure. And what, so watching those group projects, play out, what is a trait that really surprised you that you think, gosh, that's amazing that person did it. This is a perfect Mission U student. And what's a trait that came out that you're like, this person isn't a fit for this? What are you guys looking for, both for the program and, unfortunately to sort of the folks that won't make the cut?
Sure. I would say, in the admissions process, we want to see that individuals are effective collaborators and can influence others, but not in a strong-armed and non-collaborative way. So I'll give you a slight example. We had a candidate apply for our program who had gone to a very famous top-tier college out here on the West Coast that everyone knows by name. And, by all intents and purposes, you would say, okay, you should absolutely accept this person. They come from one of the best colleges in the country. They scored really high in their SAT. They've had, top GPA their whole, academic career. Of course, they're going to be a great fit for this program. And what we saw was that when they went through the group interview, they lacked patience with others. And they started to get really, really frustrated if anyone on their team disagreed with them. And they tried to strong arm everybody into their one viewpoint rather than being what I would consider, a more conscientious member of a team. And so we didn't advance that candidate. Whereas there are other candidates that were really, really thoughtful listeners and were able to analyze and synthesize the context in which their group was sharing some of their learnings. They had also done independent research through, we encourage people to use Google throughout our applications process to get to the best possible answer. And then, they were a very, very thoughtful contributor. And they were somebody that afterwards, we don't just assess each individual. We have them assess their own performance, and then we have everyone else do a peer assessment. And, what we found was folks like that oftentimes are really highly rated by others that they want to work on a team with them. And so it's not always the loudest voice in the room that can be the most effective.
You started your career as a consultant at Bain & Company, and you've talked in the press about having a foundation of skills and how important that is for anyone. What was the sort of the foundation of skills that you learned there and elsewhere that have helped you both with the Pencils of Promise and also with Mission U?
But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Dan Bova, Editorial Director of Entrepreneur.com, and I wanted to let you know that Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/HSH and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Audible has an amazing selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more. I love listening to books while I'm exercising or on my commute. Right now I'm listening to Oil and Marble by Stephanie Story. It's a fantastic novel that examines the relationship between Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo as they compete for artistic supremacy in Florence. It's a fascinating and inspiring deep dive into the minds and souls of these Renaissance masters, and I couldn't recommend it more. So go to audible.com/HSH or text HSH to 500-500 to get started today.
What was the sort of the foundation of skills that have helped you both with the Pencils of Promise and also with Mission U?
I think there's a couple. One of them in particular that I learned at Bain was just the value of really deeply investing in training an individual up front so that they can take on higher level challenges that you might yourself be trying to address rather than them. And so what I mean, having been an entrepreneur for as long as I can remember, in high school, I was probably the person who, if you had a group project, I would kind of let everyone put their piece in there. And I said, okay, whenever you guys are done, just send me what you've done, and like I'll kind of do it all myself at the end of the night. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs have this feeling of I do it better than everybody else, so just put it all on my shoulders at the end of the day. And when I entered Bain, there's just this fantastic culture that recognizes that people can grow tremendously, and a lot of the skills that enable people to succeed are able to be acquired through great training and mentorship and guidance and a culture that fosters growth, right? The you know, what's known as the growth mindset from Carol Dweck rather than a fixed mindset. And so I think that I really adopted a lot of those learnings to how I think about growing organizations and companies, whether that's Pencils of Promise previously or Mission today, is to recognize that it's really, really critical that you not see an individual as just a kind of stagnant being, right? That every one of us has the capacity to grow and evolve. And in particular, if we surround ourselves with other ambitious individuals who are seeking something more from themselves and their lives ahead, that incredible things can happen. And I saw it at Bain, and now, fortunately, you know, I get to see it when I go into the field to support the Pencils of Promise team and see our students all around the world, of which there's now more than 75,000, or when I work with our students here in the U.S. at Mission U.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting to sort of talk about this foundation of skills, because I feel like when teenagers are talking about college, they're not talking about a skill set that they want to be taking into the rest of their lives, or they're talking about an end goal. Sometimes they're mm-hmm. like, "Oh, I want to mm-hmm. be this thing," and they're not maybe putting themselves in the right path, because maybe they don't necessarily know all of the different things about themselves yet to know if that path mm-hmm. would be a fit. What are we getting wrong when we're sort of looking at like how we forge ahead in our careers, whether we're students or just even people who are just looking to make the most of their time on this rock, right? You know, when we're talking about a foundation of skills, what's the gap here? What are we not getting?
One thing that I'll just caveat all of this with is that it's always an evolution.
Sure.
Right. Individuals are constantly improving and growing, but that might not always match what the world looks like today or what it's about to look like tomorrow or in the years ahead. So, you know, what I'll say is relevant now might not be relevant if someone listens to this 3 years from now, and they'll kind of laugh and say, "Oh, that was important back then, but geez, things have changed so much." And I acknowledge, you know, the only constant is change, certainly in this environment as well. That said, I think that, a lot of young people in particular today, although the majority of college students are no longer just young people, there's more working adults attending college than traditional students. That said, though, I think most people look at college historically, you know, it started out as this opportunity for apprenticeship, you know, at the very beginning of college. And, you know, most of the last 50 or so years, people have looked at it as an opportunity to learn and grow and evolve. And then hopefully at the end of that, have a better job and economic security going forward. And just given the explosion in the cost of college over the last 30 years, but in particular the last 10, the cost has just become so insane that 91% of all freshmen today, when asked what's the number one reason that you're going to college, say to get a better job. And I think the misalignment is that you have very, very few college administrators and professors who see that as their core responsibility, right? They're not there to get somebody a better job. They're there to teach them a specific area in which they have oftentimes an academic interest. And there isn't a lot of firm connection to what's actually happening in the labor market, what, you know, top companies are looking for, and what careers actually need out of talent these days. And so, you know, I think that there's a really significant amount, first and foremost, of introspection that needs to go on, and holistic self-development. The ideal path would be that an individual figures out what kind of, you know, or at least has a hypothesis around which career they want to pursue. And in light of that, then they should probably identify a major that's going to help them learn that. And then they should probably look for schools that specialize in that major and then apply to those schools. But, you know, what actually happens is the exact opposite, right? You know, a person says, "Oh, I want to go to this college," because they have some type of, you know, brand affiliation with that school. They go to that school, and then once they're there, they say, "Ooh, maybe I can get interested in this major." And then based on whether they're interested or not, then on the back end, they say, "Maybe that can help me, you know, position myself for career success." But if you look at the data, very few people are actually in careers that have any relevance to what they studied in college. So, you know, I think that, you know, there are skills that you can list out. In particular, I would say understanding, you know, how to use information and numbers and data to drive better decisions. Is being increasingly, you know, I would say not only relevant, but essential for almost every industry. You know, a year ago, I would have said it's absolutely critical for business. But when you look at other spaces like health or environment, you know, customer service, et cetera, all these things, sales, operations, management, whatever it looks like, you know, there's a plethora of information and data that we as individuals, as companies, as organizations now have access to, and we should use those to make better decisions. And, you know, leaders across the board recognize that. And so I think there's this foundational toolkit that so many of us need. But the other side of that pendulum swing that college oftentimes fails on today, and I know has become a big focus for us and something that our students love at Mission U, is these real world skills, mm-hmm. right? I mean, how do you do cold outreach to somebody? How do you conduct an informational interview? How do you balance your checkbook and actually get some type of hold on financial literacy? These are things that I think college really should be delivering on, but rarely does.
Yeah, it's interesting. And so when you launched Mission U, it was nearly 10 years between that and your other launch with Pencils of Promise. What's changed? How was the launch for Mission U sort of different than the one for Pencils of Promise?
Wildly different. I mean, you know, you got to keep in mind Pencils of Promise. I was 24. All I wanted to do was build one school in the developing world. And that was really the entirety of the initial ambition, was just this very personal project. You know, my grandma was turning 80. I wanted to build a school and hopefully dedicate it to her and honor her. And I put $25 in a bank account and threw a birthday party and asked people to give $20 at the door. That was the launch.
Yeah.
Was, you know, 400 people came to a birthday party. And we had a little bit of money and we bootstrapped it from there. And it was, you know, probably two and a half years before anyone really paid attention. And that was after we reached maybe 10 or 15 schools. With Mission U, it's been very different. I mean, you know, we've raised more than $10 million in our first year to go after what is a problem that eventually we believe that we'll raise, you know, many, many, many millions of dollars to pursue this. But I think the, you know, I'll call it just appetite for individuals to play a part in solving this problem is just so big in this present moment, because everyone is affected by it within, you know, a degree or two of separation. You know, within, I would say the first, I mean, it was probably the first 6 months, maybe call it a year of launch, but, you know, we were featured in major profiles on the Today Show. You know, there's a 2-page spread in Time Magazine about Mission U. You know, the rate of acceleration has just been extraordinary at Mission U. And it gives me great hope and great excitement about the notion that, you know, there's just huge traction around this idea that we need higher education programs that give people not only the skills and experiences that will enable them to thrive, but also doesn't position them for, you know, crushing student debt, and instead gives them a clear path to their future.
Sure. But I think it's also important to mention that, you know, when you did your first launch, you know, you didn't have a family yet. And the second launch, you had two little ones who were, you know, just a few months old. You know, how does that sort of change, you know, where you can prioritize and where your bandwidth is, and also just how much sleep you have, right? I mean,
So I do have twins. We have a little boy and a girl, my son Dylan and my daughter Bayla. And, it changes everything. Absolutely. You know, I think two things change in particular. One is your ability to prioritize. It's just never been more clear for me. I've never said no to more things without hesitation or remorse, because I know that if I say yes to something, even if it's not something I'm committed to, that's actually going to take time away from something else. And oftentimes it will, you know, extend a workday, and then that workday blends or bleeds into the time that I could be spending with my children.
Sure.
And so I say no a lot more. I understand the value of focus and priorities. And then the second thing is I think it drastically changes your sense of purpose. You know, with Pencils of Promise, I really wanted to have a major impact on an issue that I deeply cared about, global education. But I wanted to have this really large impact. I wanted to affect as many people as possible in a positive way that would meaningfully improve their lives and lives of their future generations. And, you know, I remember being so conflicted in the first month after we brought our twins home, because honestly, that stuff meant nothing to me relative to how much I cared about the health and well-being of my children and my wife, because we had a lot of health complications, as often happens with twins. And, you know, the most important thing to me in the world was actually this very small life, this small existence of just caring for and, you know, being a good father and husband, and just wanting to be in this one little room with the other three people I care so much about. And over time, I think, you know, it took a few months to reconcile, but I realized the single best thing I can do is just set an example for them as not only a good father and husband, but ultimately just a human in the world trying to, you know, make the lives of others better. And so, you know, it's certainly difficult when you don't get nearly as much sleep as you're used to. You know, you always want to be with your children. And, you know, 5 days a week, at least, I'm stepping out the door and spending the majority of my hours away from them at our office. But they motivate me every single day. And, you know, the time that I have with them is without a doubt my, you know, favorite moments.
Of course, of course. Even with Mission, you know, having the visibility that you had been able to build up and the trust that people had built up in you, you know, since you'd already had a successful organization with Pencils of Promise. You know, so you start Mission U with great visibility, name recognition, mm-hmm. and trust, which is wonderful, right? But there's still a hell of a lot of work to do, right?
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, it's not like, oh, we just turned this thing on and you just merge, you know, put the switch mark, you know, public benefit corporation, and then you're good. So what is the... tell me about maybe like it's got new challenges, new initiative. Tell me about a wall you hit early on where, just like everybody hits, a wall that you hit early on where you're like, oh, crap, how are we going to do this? Is there a moment like that where you're like, okay, this is a new one?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, we've fortunately had, you know, fantastic retention. We have 90%+ retention for students in the program, which is frankly unheard of in any type of higher education program. But that said, I mean, you know, when you start something like this and it's an education organization, you know, a lot of people on the outside assume that education can be, I'll call it as transactional as other industries, where you've enrolled a student and therefore that's going to lead to success. In the same way that you sell a product and therefore you've kind of completed the work. And, you know, now a decade of work in education, the one thing that's most clear to me is just how deeply human the industry is and how deeply human the work becomes when you are interfacing with real people on a day-to-day basis and how much their lives oftentimes are unpredictable and not something that you can anticipate by designing great curriculum. So, you know, our curriculum, our instructors, everything across the board, I truly believe is absolutely top notch. That said, you know, we've had, you know, a student who had moved across the country. All students live within 50 miles of their cohort city. And so that enables them to have flexibility to, you know, afford rent wherever it makes sense, either expensive downtown or cheaper outskirts, but also be able to come together at minimum every other week when we bring them together for these live in-person sessions and have the group cohesion that is so important to the community that we're creating and, you know, the friendships that they're building for life with their classmates. And, you know, we had a student who had, you know, multiple people that this student knew die in the same week. Completely unexpected. But they were very close to these people. They were very meaningful parts of their lives. And they had to reconcile, you know, this incredible, horrific set of tragedies. And at the same time, we're sitting there, you know, with this very immersive, very demanding curriculum that requires a lot of their focus. And, you know, immediately we said, oh my gosh, we need to put real support systems in place for our students beyond just, you know, academic tutoring, but, you know, what you would consider more of kind of the human-oriented services. And it's not something that I think until that moment we realized, oh my gosh, this could spring up at any point in time. And it's absolutely critical that we have the ability to support this, you know, any student on a moment's notice for something that might not be related whatsoever to our curriculum or the mission you experience, but is absolutely essential to their well-being. And so that's something that we designed, we put in place. The team has been fantastic in that regard. But that was definitely one of those moments where we said, ooh, this is about a lot more than, you know, shiny press articles you know, great awareness. This is about real people and their very real experiences, and we need to be there for them.
Sure, sure. And what is the support service in the future if someone went through something horrific like that? What would they experience from Mission U?
Yeah, we have essentially therapists that are, you know, on contract with us. Students get allotted a certain number of sessions that we will heavily subsidize. They pay almost nothing for them, very, very minimal. And so at any point in time, if they need what I would consider more kind of social and human support services, we have somebody that's right on call that, you know, is deeply vetted and has now worked with several of our students and I think been a huge blessing.
Sure, sure. Are there other things that you never expected that you'd be wrangling, hiring, putting into place? I mean, you know, like, oh, we're going to put together this sort of alternative university, but you never would have imagined you'd be sort of wrangling that detail or that that segment.
You know, the truth is, being now a multi-time entrepreneur, but in particular, second time around building something of size and substance, you know, all the things I did before this, you know, we're not 7-8 figure, et cetera, organizations. Pencil Promise to date has raised more than $50 million, you know, 100 plus staff in 5 different countries. I'm now pretty well equipped to anticipate that the unknown is going to hit. You know, I think the first time around for me, you know, the you know, mountains and valleys are higher and lower in that respective regard. I think once you've been through it before, especially at the length of time that I've now spent being an entrepreneur and a full-time CEO, you're pretty well handled for it. And you kind of are able to anticipate the challenges around the curve. You know, I think the main one that we've seen is just how difficult the ability to recruit talent can be in a really competitive market. That's probably the one that I think I've been maybe most surprised by is, you know, we at Pencils of Promise, we're based out of New York, and our headquarters for Mission U is in San Francisco. And there's just a very, very different vibe here. There's a different set of expectations. And that's something that it's taken a little bit of adjustment for me to get used to. But at the same time, I made the conscious decision to move my family out here and start Mission U headquartered out here. And it was because of all the wonderful things that the Bay Area provides. And so I'm very happy with it. But there's a very big cultural difference between New York and San Francisco, and that maybe took me 6 months or so to get used to.
Sure, sure. Was part of the capability that you were tapping into in the Bay Area, was it also just sort of these tech companies that you could connect students with?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have a ton of relationships. Our students, I would say, you know, every month are going and visiting a top company, spending time with their leadership. You know, last night we, at our space where we hold student events, we also hosted an open meetup. We had a packed house, and you know, we ran a panel, and that panel was on what we considered top tech recruiting. So getting into sales, marketing, and data analytics at top companies, and we had four different recruiters, lead recruiters from companies like Pinterest and others, there explaining to that crowd, of which, you know, many of our students showed up, some of you know, the people that want to apply to the program showed up, but there was also just, you know, the general folks that were interested and saw the event on Eventbrite in San Francisco and wanted to come. And, you know, being in SF, that those types of things can materialize very quickly. You know, the first day of orientation for our very first cohort of students, we were hosted by Spotify, one of our partners, and that was really fantastic. But at the end of the day, there was a panel of folks working in data analytics and data science, which is our first major, is in data analytics and business intelligence. And the folks on the stage that I was looking at work at, let's see, Spotify, Uber, Twitter, Allstate, and Shipt. And Shipt was bought for $200 million since that panel. And so, you know, just the types of things that are being created in this city are just extraordinary. And I think there's a general mentality of, you know, wanting to move the world forward, but also be collaborative and help one another. And more than just make money, but actually, you know, do something that is good for society. And that's something that I've really enjoyed being around.
I talk to a lot of founders all the time. And what I think is really interesting about folks that have some years under their belt is the ability to anticipate when change is going to happen, and also like change for themselves. What's that like for you? Like, what are you feeling? What are you seeing? And how do you like kind of cope with it?
Sure. It's such a good question. And I appreciate you asking it, because not a lot of people, you know, I think have that depth of awareness into what it's like on this side. But, you know, I think one thing that I've certainly grown into is someone who just has conviction. When I get behind something, I'm all in. It takes me a while to get to that place. But once I have that conviction, I think a lot of other people, frankly, give up on an idea too early. They're just not willing to put in the work. They're not willing to put in the hours that you have to endure, where no one else believes that what you're doing is going to succeed. And that's really hard, because most people seek validation from external sources. And when enough people say, hey, it's not going to happen, or this doesn't look right, they give in and they just stop and they say, okay, you're right, my idea isn't good enough, or this pathway isn't good enough, and I'm gonna stop. And I think the founders that succeed just have this relentless conviction that comes from a place that is not passion, but instead purpose. They fundamentally believe that part of their existence is to bring this thing into the world. And I'm certainly one of those people. And so that's something where I think my resolve has only been strengthened when I get behind an idea in ways that maybe it wasn't when I was younger, if I was 17 or 18. And then the second thing is I have a real commitment this time around to take care of my health and well-being. Mm-hmm. And perhaps part of that is being in, you know, your mid-30s or having kids. But, you know, it's important for me to eat well, to be physically active, to take care of my, you know, mental health just by getting in a quick meditation in the morning, where I'm able to kind of press pause for a little bit to spend time with my wife and children. And at the same time, to build a culture where my employees and, you know, my co-founder feel that they can do the same. Yeah. Those are all things that are really important to me. And I think the first time around, it was something that kind of oftentimes fell by the wayside, and I'd reach a point of burnout and then I'd have to reset. And you know, this time around, I don't want to get to a place where I fully burn out and have to press reset. And that means working really, really hard, but putting in, I think, measures that allow for, you know, greater overall well-being.
Sure, sure. What are some other measures that you've sort of put in place to make sure that you have that well-being?
Sure. So, I mean, I can walk you through a little bit of my routine. So first and foremost is every morning before, or let's even start with the night before, I do not sleep with my phone in my room, nor is it on in a way that it can receive any inbound messages, even in a different room. So when I go to commit to going to sleep at night, I put my phone in airplane mode, and it goes into a charger in a completely separate room from wherever I'm trying to sleep. That's something that I implemented probably 5 or 6 years ago, and has been absolutely critical for me so that I can get a good night's sleep, because I'm the type, as many people are, where you have an idea or you get a curiosity, you pick up your phone and suddenly you're awake for 2 hours. So I sleep with my phone in airplane mode in a different room. Second thing is when I wake up in the morning, before I get up or reach for a phone in a different room, brushing it, before I do anything, the first thing that I do is I put my hand on my wife's shoulder and I just take a few deep breaths and just say a few words of gratitude to her or, you know, to whoever might be listening up above. But I express some form of gratitude, and I make sure that I have human connection before I have any type of digital connection. Mm-hmm. And I think that really helps with the anxiety that a lot of people feel when you're constantly connected, and constantly looking at the next task ahead of you. Next thing is, I don't get a chance to do it every day. It depends on, you know, how hectic the day is going to be. But the majority of days I make a commitment, if I can get up early, to go into my little home office, and I do, depending on how much time I have, 10 to 15 minute meditation first thing in the morning. I found Headspace to be particularly helpful there, but there's Oak and there's Calm and there's a few others. And then after that, I go and I change some diapers.
Sure.
You know, I do the non-glorious work of taking care of, you know, 30 diapers and kids. And after I've completed that, which is called 30 minutes of bottles and stuff like that, then I look at my phone. And I think I had to give myself the permission to not start emailing first thing in the morning. But eventually I realized, you know, I'm up at 7:15, maybe 7. There's no one that's sitting there at 7:45 saying, how come Adam hasn't responded to the email that I just sent him?
Yeah.
You know, I can give myself the permission to start replying to emails at 8 a.m. And, you know, after that, I head out the door pretty soon and head into the office. And then I make a very concerted effort. And our full team knows this, that I try and leave in time to put my kids down. And they go down around 6, you know, bath time and whatnot. That's very important to me, that I have that time with them, even if it's 30 minutes, you know, 45 minutes, just putting them down in the dark. And then I can get back online after that and get in a workout or, you know, see a friend or do some more work.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think has helped you develop that system that works for you? What maybe quality or something that, like, gosh, if I didn't have this quality, I never would have developed that.
The main thing I would say is I journal.
Yeah.
I've had a journal since I was 16 that I've kept, and, you know, now there's a couple dozen of them filled up. I make a point of buying a really nice, like, leather-bound journal, one that I take pride in. Has really beautiful paper. And so every, you know, word that I put down on that page, I value, I care about. I don't write with the expectation that anyone will ever read it. You know, maybe on my, like, deathbed, my great-grandkids will read me back some of the tales or whatnot, but it's really for a place for me to express my deepest inner truths, and I just find that it comes out more effectively when I'm writing on the page, more so than if I'm typing up or talking to somebody. You know, you kind of have to still yourself a little bit. It happens a little bit more slowly to handwrite. Mm-hmm. And I don't write, you know, every day or even every week, but I make sure that I write, I would say, at least once a month. And that practice has been incredibly helpful for me to recognize, you know, parts of my life that are going well and parts that aren't. Mm-hmm. And I think coming out of doing that, you know, habit consistently now for, call it 18 years, I just got to a place where I frankly know myself, and I know when I'm at my best and I know when I'm not. And I try new things all the time to improve that feeling. And sometimes, you know, I discover something. Like, since moving to San Francisco, I discovered that I love mountain biking. And so every weekend, either Saturday or Sunday or both days when my kids are napping, I go out for a 2-hour mountain bike ride. And it's become a really important part of my routine. So I think part of it is exposure to new things. And then the other part is just, you know, doing the deep hard work of really getting to know yourself.
Sure, sure. And to me, that's sort of beyond even mindfulness, right? Because I feel when people talk about mindfulness, they kind of go into some other, they have a lot of baggage when they talk about that. It's a charged word. To me, it's almost like a thoughtfulness, right? It's beyond that because it's also about yourself. It's not just about the moment and sort of like, you know, not being anxious and not keeping away from your phone. It's about human connection. It's about sort of understanding what you really want. I mean, am I making something out of thin air? Am I getting close to something? Do you feel that sort of connection to, like, you know, I want to be deliberate. I want to be thoughtful about how I do this, you know? Yeah.
No, I think there's an intentionality that's required to get to a place where you genuinely are very happy with your life, knowing that there are going to be peaks and valleys. And, you know, there's no job that I know of that creates more stress or peaks and valleys than starting something, than being a founder, because it's not just your job. It's your life. It's your reputation. It's your credibility with, you know, your friends, your family, the outside world, and most importantly, with yourself. And so you have to be very intentional, and I think that you're describing it very appropriately.
Yeah. I have one last question for you, sir, and then I can release you into your day. I read a great line of yours, and it was this notion that we should always be the student and the teacher in every room. Can you explain a little bit about what that is and how anybody listening to this can do a little bit more of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the intention behind sharing that, which I do a lot of public speaking, you know, the book that I wrote, The Promise of a Pencil, became a New York Times bestseller. And so a lot of colleges and companies and associations said, we want you to come in and, you know, share your stories and insights. And, you know, one day going into speech, I thought, what's something new that I can share? And it's just this notion that every one of us has, I think, a responsibility to be both a teacher and a student in every room that we enter, because we have something both to offer and we have something both to learn in every person that we meet. And there's no doubt about it. I mean, you can literally learn something from a 4-year-old if you're an 80-year-old, and obviously vice versa. And so I think there's a lot of power in approaching situations with what's considered a beginner's mindset, where you assume that you know very little and you are open to gaining new knowledge. You don't bring your biases, your expectations. But at the same time, you know, you have so much to offer to others. And the act of, you know, sharing those experiences and those sets of knowledge and those insights and providing mentorship to a stranger or a new relationship, I think is really important. And so, you know, we have people in our society that have been kind of deemed that they carry this wisdom that they need to give out to others. And there's a lot of people who kind of sit there and think, oh, I just need to learn from others. But, you know, I found that, you know, the best relationships and the best experiences evolve out of this mentality in which both participants in a dialogue and a conversation seek to be both a teacher and a student.
Awesome. Very good. Well, thank you so much, sir. This has been wonderful.
My pleasure. Yeah, thank you so much. And, you know, one thing that I'll just share, if anyone's listening to this and wants to reach out to me personally, I always like to give out my email. It's just adam@ipromise.org, the letter ipromise.org. Feel free to reach out to me directly, and, you know, happy to continue the conversation with any of your listeners. And we are taking applications at Mission U and looking for great people. So encourage anyone out there to either apply personally or go to our website and, you know, send a great person our way.
Awesome. And before we go, some short announcements for our listeners. How Success Happens comes out weekly. To make sure you don't miss a single episode, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud, or wherever you get your favorite podcast. And don't be afraid to leave us a review. It helps us improve and reach more listeners just like you. For more stories like this one on the mindset you need to start and grow a business, go to entrepreneur.com. And to let me know what you think about the show, find me on Twitter at Linda Lacina. That's the at symbol, L-I-N-D-A-L-A-C-I-N-A. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.